Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzschrauber. On today's show, the FBI and facial recognition technology. Most of you listeners probably have a driver's license, but you probably don't know that 18 states allow the FBI to scan that license. Another 10 allow state and local law enforcement to do the same thing. And because of this, 1 in 2 American adults, that's 125 million people, are in an FBI facial recognition database. How did we get here, and how do we even know about this? Wouldn't the government want to keep this kind of thing a secret? Well, my next guest did a bunch of work and figured this out, so we have him to thank for it. He's Alvaro Bedoya, Executive Director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. They've got a new report coming out, or not coming out, it's been out, at perpetuallineup.org. We'll link to that in the show notes for today, but it's a report about the state of facial recognition technology in the United States. Alvaro, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, are we in a permanent police lineup?
The funny thing is that in many ways we are. And what do I mean by that? If late at night the police knocked on your door and you opened it up and they said, hey, there's been a robbery in your neighborhood, but we have good news. We got the guy. Will you come down to the police station and stand in the lineup? We need your help. I think most people would say no. I think most people would probably prefer not to do that. And yet, as you just said, 1 out of 2 Americans, just by having a driver's license, have actually said yes. And almost all of those people have no idea that they've said yes. Their faces are scanned for criminal investigations, much like criminals' fingerprints. And there are basically no controls and little oversight over this whole process.
And if there are so few controls and so little oversight, how does someone like you who doesn't work for the FBI figure out the scale of this surveillance?
With a dedicated team of people, Claire Garvey, our associate, Jonathan Frankel, technologists, and about a dozen other researchers, a core team of 3 or 4 within that. Claire and our staff FOIA'd, used the Freedom of Information Act to request documents from over 100 state and local law enforcement agencies around the country. And we used the documents we received, that was over 16,000 pages of documents, to boil it all down to some pretty powerful numbers. As you said, 28 states that allow the FBI or state or local police to search driver's license faces like they would criminals' fingerprints, and that's 125 million Americans, 1 out of every 2 adults.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy, and there are some really interesting findings in the report, so I would recommend that anyone check that out. So what's the justification here? I mean, let's assume that the FBI has a good reason for wanting this kind of access. What is the purpose of the facial recognition database?
It's to identify people in photos that the police have. But here's the thing. Historically, if the police wanted to identify you, they had to walk up to you. They had to talk to you. They had to ask you for ID. Face recognition lets them do this from far away and in secret. Then you might say, hey, wait a second. You know, couldn't they identify me from a latent fingerprint or a DNA sample? And the answer is yes. But this was a one-off targeted process that involved, say, a crime scene investigator stooping down to collect a hair sample or fingerprint.
Yeah, they don't make you give away your DNA when you turn 18 so that like
Precisely.
Everyone has it, right? The idea is that you shouldn't be in the system if you haven't committed a crime.
And that the idea is that this has never happened before. Not with DNA, not with criminals' fingerprints. National DNA and fingerprint databases are either entirely or in their majority made up of criminals' submissions, right? Criminals' DNA, victims' DNA, criminals' fingerprints. If you look at all of the databases that the FBI can either search directly or request searches of, that data, that network is made up 80% of law-abiding people, of taxpayers, and that has never happened.
Right. So what's the process here? So the FBI wants to use the algorithm to search the database, and they either have a reason or they don't. What is the internal process right now, given that we don't know a lot about this? Do we have a sense of how these decisions are made and who at FBI gets to decide when they query the database?
Right. Usually what happens, based on the documents we've seen and based on FBI testimony, is an FBI agent has a photo and they want to identify the person in the photo. And here's when the process starts going wrong in our view. Do they need to actually suspect the person in that photo of of actually having committed a crime or a serious crime before they can request a search of a driver's license database? No. These searches can be requested on mere, quote, allegation or information. Okay, this is not an even reasonable suspicion that the person is suspected of a crime. And so they can be requested basically for any criminal justice reason. And then what they do is they submit this request to their face services unit, which is a specialized unit of face recognition specialists, and they will either directly run a search of a state's database, or in most instances, they request a search of the DMV or the state or local police.
So what are the current safeguards? I mean, your report concludes with a lot of recommendations on what needs to change, but it'd be interesting to look at the existing process to see if maybe there is a safeguard in there that's not being implemented properly. And our legal fellow, Ashkin Kanzarian, wrote a blog post about this where she mentioned that the E-Government Act requires a privacy impact statement. So, you know, that's obviously some jargon, but what that sounds to me is that if the FBI were to do something like what you're describing, they would have needed to, I don't know, write something about why this right. is needed and how they're going to safeguard people's privacy. Is that requirement in the E-Government Act just being ignored right now?
It was ignored for years and years. And so to answer your question, what kind of safeguards are in place, few and far between. The E-Government Act and the Privacy Act both have basic rules that say, hey, you know, federal government, when you develop a system that has the detailed records of your citizens, you need to tell them about it in either a privacy impact assessment or what's called a system of records notice. These may sound like obscure bureaucratic filings, but it is the basic means by which the federal government is required to tell the people it serves how it's tracking them. And for 4.5 years, the FBI was running, either letting states run searches of its own database, which is mugshots, or running searches of states' driver's license databases. And for these 4 or so years, the FBI did not put either a new privacy impact assessment or a system of records notice out. It left the public in the dark.
And this is just transparency. This isn't even a restriction on how the FBI uses the database. This is merely a transparency requirement, which is about the bare minimum you could expect.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And when you look past that transparency requirement, you find an awful little. There is not a single state in the union that regulates face recognition like states regulate wiretaps or email requests, which isn't exactly a high standard right now, or automated license plate readers or geolocation information. So there's no state law that comprehensively regulates this. There's no federal law. There's little bits and pieces of state law that say, hey, you know, maybe scrub your database. Not maybe. Michigan says you got to scrub your face recognition, your mugshot database of people who haven't been convicted of a crime.
So you've got 28 states. Only 2 of them actually acknowledge that this is happening with some type of law on the books, and even those are not sufficient. So it is problematic in and of itself that you have over 120 million people in a database. But setting aside that problem, let's talk about the actual technology and does it work and is it effective? So you've got the Next Generation Identification Interstate Photo System, which is a very clumsy acronym and name. We're going to call that the FBI database. And your report says that it's got a 20% margin of error. That sounds like a lot when you're dealing with identifying someone who committed a crime. How does the FBI mitigate the 20% margin of error? What happens if they screw up?
So here's what we know. A couple of years ago, the FBI ran a test of a subset of its database of about 1 million faces. A year ago, it was about 25 million mugshots. Now it's even more than that. But it took a sliver of that database. And it ran a test for when it knew the perpetrator, the quote-unquote perpetrator, was in the system. And 1 out of 7 searches for a perpetrator's face, when they were in the system, returned a list of faces of totally innocent people. Okay, so in other words, so 86% of the time, out of 50 guesses, the system returned a list including the perpetrator. But 1 out of 7 times, even though it had dozens of chances to find the perpetrator, the system totally missed the perpetrator. And here's the thing. There's a funny thing that happens with face recognition where as your database gets larger, you have doppelgangers. You have more people that look like you.
Yeah.
So accuracy goes down. And so we have no idea how accuracy would go down or how much it would go down if the FBI had tested its system not on a million faces, but on 28 million faces or 50 million faces.
Or if they just take the whole country and just do
there
it
you
that
go.
Way.
There you
so
go.
That's actually interesting, and that's kind of counterintuitive. I think most people would assume that having more data
right.
means more accuracy and less of a margin of error. And in this case, it's actually, it'd be better if they were running an algorithm maybe on 10 people instead of 10 million.
Right.
And so beyond the fact that, they've got a margin of error. What happens to someone if they're mistakenly identified? Is there a safeguard there? Because you can imagine that that could seriously impact someone's life in a negative way if they are accused of a crime they did not commit.
There is no safeguard there. And let me tell you how we know that. We went down to Pinellas County, Florida, and this is the oldest face recognition system in the country. It's been running since 2001. 8,000 searches a month on 7 million Floridian drivers' faces, without warrants, without court oversight, without any kind of audits. And this was on the sheriff himself told us so. No audits. And we went down to the public defender's office to see how many times the public defender had been told, "We found the accused. We found the defendant." Through a face recognition search, a photo of a bank robbery, of some other kind of surveillance still. And he said, zero. We have never been told in Brady evidence that they found our client using face recognition. He said, look, we have heard a couple cases where, you know, an officer stopped our client in the street and asked him for identification. They didn't have any, so they took a photo, and that's how they figured out his or her name. But in terms of actual forensic use of face recognition, which is one of the dominant uses, he had never been told of its use. And all this is a long and complicated way of saying that you never have a chance to contest this in court.
Right. And that's part of the, you know, basic due process in our country. This idea that it doesn't always play out this way, but there's a general idea that if the prosecution has information on you, and you as the defense attorney and the defendant should have some way of figuring out how they came to accuse you of this crime. So you're suggesting that you could go through an entire trial, either get convicted or get acquitted, and never find out that the reason you were accused is because of a false facial recognition?
You also wouldn't find out if you were third on the list or fourth on the list, and there was someone who looked more like the person in that incriminating photo than you. And I would think that's exculpatory information that your defense attorney should have.
And recently, Congress gave the FBI a chance to explain itself. And the results were interesting. You were one of the witnesses talking about the privacy implications. Another witness was from the FBI. And members of Congress put a lot of the questions I'm asking you today to the FBI. What happened? What did the FBI have to say for itself?
To be honest, I'm not sure what happened. There are
it all happened so fast.
I urge listeners
over the course of 2 or 3 hours.
Right, right. I urge folks who are listening to watch. You know, if you do have a moment.
As far as congressional hearings go, this one was actually pretty entertaining, and you can't say that about many. And I'll just say, I mean, you had a great moment where Representative Chaffetz, who's the chairman of the Oversight Committee in the House. He just said, "I'm sorry, you seem like a nice person, but we don't believe you," to the FBI witness.
Right, right, right.
And it seemed like the creepy factor was bipartisan.
That was actually the most heartening thing about that hearing, because privacy is not a Democratic or Republican issue. Privacy is an issue of rights and fundamental liberties. And it was. Frankly, you know, I was a Hill staffer for 5 years. I was chief counsel to Senator Franken. I was and a subcommittee on privacy. I have never seen a hearing where the members were so aligned in their concern about government overreach. And I attended a lot of those NSA hearings because I was staffing my boss on them. And I frankly staffed and at his direction, you know, set up many of those for him, or one or two of those for him. But yeah, you know, you had conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats saying, wait a second, you are scanning my face without telling me, without warrants, without oversight, without audits, and with a pretty darn low accuracy rate. They could not believe it. And the funny thing, I want to be fair to FBI because they have caught some dangerous criminals this way. And that story wasn't really told at the hearing. I don't know why. And so where we come out on it at the end is we don't want to ban this technology. We want to make sure it's actually used for bona fide criminal investigations when there's probable cause that the person has actually committed a crime, and in serious crimes. And in certain cases, we think there should be a warrant.
Yeah, and of course, there's definitely legitimate applications, and we can kind of close out the show with figuring out what that balance is. But there's another issue here, which is potential for racial bias.
Yes.
And I kind of think about it two ways. One, just in general, the criminal justice system has been found to disproportionately impact the lives of especially low-income African-Americans and Hispanics. But then there's also the technological aspect. Does the technology treat a face differently based on the complexion? I mean, I don't know how facial recognition technology works, but I could imagine that someone who looks like me, the software might interact differently than an African-American. I mean, is that a thing?
More research needs to be done, but all science suggests that it very much is a thing. And the top research paper on this was actually co-written by an FBI face recognition specialist in 2012. And they looked at several leading algorithms. And they found that the algorithms were more likely to miss, to fail to find the faces of African-Americans, women, and young people as compared to white people, men, and older people. Now, if you are a libertarian and listening to this, you might say, I have no problem with government face recognition systems not finding me, but here is the problem. Some of these systems are designed to give you a no for an answer, okay? So you look for a certain face, sorry, sir, we didn't find it, is effectively what the system would tell you,
right?
Because we're not confident enough about the potential matches. Other systems, Evan, are not designed to give you no for an answer.
They just do the best guess.
Precisely. And so in those scenarios, if you are African American, if you are a woman, if you are a person aged 18 to 30, or if you are all three, it seems to be the case that the system is more likely to actually miss the perpetrator and serve up a list of candidates who are innocent people.
Yeah, so that would be – so even though it's interesting you bring up that, yeah, the ineffectiveness of the technology might be comforting to some people, that's actually not great because they're not catching the right guy.
Exactly right. They're not catching the criminal.
And someone else is now getting accused. And is there a human backstop here? I mean, we've talked about in other cases on this show, we've talked about how does a company like Facebook make sure that when someone reports child porn, it's actually child porn. That means that someone – unfortunately, whoever has this job, and I hope they get paid well, has to look at some of the most heinous stuff on the internet to make sure that the algorithm was right and that there's a human editorial element there that can decide. How does the FBI factor human beings into the technology?
Right. So this is a good spot to give the FBI credit because here they actually do the right thing. They actually have specially trained face examiners at the end of their face service, in their face services unit, that when they run a request to search of a state database, they get it back and they call it down to just one or two candidates to give back to the actual FBI agent or other federal official that they're doing the search for. But here's the thing, most states do not have that. Most states do not have specially trained examiners. So instead, an awful lot of police officers are getting these algorithmic answers blind, when in reality, the best systems have a specialized human that can say, no, the system got it wrong here, or they can cull it down. And so most systems don't have that specialized human backstop.
And this could be a resource problem. I mean, your local law enforcement agency is probably less equipped to have that human being than the FBI. But then, of course, the FBI is more shady about this. So there's all these layers. But just like with most technology, it can be used for good, or it can be used for bad. And it's not just either you have it or you don't. And you could imagine a situation where police are chasing a criminal on foot. He goes into the DC metro system, and now they've lost him and they can't find him because it's crowded and it's rush hour.
Right.
And they decide they do know that there's a criminal in there. I guess that counts as probable cause. And then they decide to scan the surveillance cameras in the DC metro to find the criminal. And maybe they agree to destroy any other people who come up who are innocent. You're going to have a very hard time finding anyone who thinks that's not okay. Even the most tinfoil hat wearing libertarians are going to say, you know what? The guy was a criminal and they definitely had cause. Now you have another situation.
this goes back to Martin Luther King and Vietnam protests, and you have protests that police or governments find to be either annoying or threatening, and because they control the levers of power, they can say, hey, FBI, I want to know everyone that's at that Dakota protest, or I want to know everyone that's out in the streets of New York City doing protesting, whatever. Is there currently any restriction on the FBI where they can use it for the good purpose or they can't use it for the bad purpose?
In our view, there's no meaningful restriction. There is no requirement that you reasonably suspect someone of a crime. There's no requirement you have probable cause, definitely no requirement of that. You generally need to use it for criminal justice purposes. But here's the thing that happens at a protest. People obstruct the entrances to buildings. People are loud and violate noise ordinances. They obstruct traffic. Those are all, in many places, crimes. And just to make clear that this is not some kind of paranoid thing they're going to use it on protests, if you look back at old FBI presentations on how this technology could be used, one of the use cases was illustrating how it could be used at the 2008 presidential rallies for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
So they were bragging about this capability.
I don't want to say bragging, but they're certainly showing how it could be used.
Yeah, it seems like the kind of thing you would not say as a potential benefit when
right.
It's one of the things that allows people like us to criticize it.
And here's the other thing. It was used more or less in this way, it would seem, at the Freddie Gray protests.
Right, so, Freddie Gray was, remind our listeners.
Yeah. So Freddie Gray was a Baltimore man who was killed by the police. The circumstances are mysterious, but he went into a police van, and when he came out, he was near death. The exact details I don't have at my fingertips, but right, I think he just ran away from the cops.
Yeah, that was part of the point of the case, is right. We don't know, but what we do know is that there was a big backlash
right.
from people in
right.
Baltimore,
exactly.
and there were
exactly.
a lot of protests,
right.
and what happened?
So there were a lot of protests, and what appears to have happened, and we know this thanks to the ACLU of Northern California, huge credit to them, they FOIA'd this vendor of social media monitoring technology to law enforcement called Geofedia. And in one of their promotional materials, they say, you know what we did in Baltimore? Baltimore County Police were able to submit photos that protesters had posted on social media and run those using face recognition to find people who were wanted among those protesters. Now, here's the thing. You could be wanted for an awful lot of things in this country. Failure to pay to appear in court. Failure to pay traffic tickets. And then followed by failure to appear in court, right? the Geofedia, the vendors, the people selling this technology, say it was rioters. But if you look through everything that the Maryland law enforcement agents said about this, they did not call these people rioters. They said that it was used, in the general vicinity in which there was rioting. And so I think there's a really good argument that this was used on innocent people to try to weed, to try to discourage people from attending those protests, get them out of there. In fact, we know that Elijah Cummings, actually, the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, actually was there. And had we don't know whether his face was scanned, but we know that happened. And in fact, he said in the hearing that that he wonders whether his own face was scanned. So we need to think about this. This is a real threat.
So, and you bring up an important point, is that as alarming and as creepy as this is, we have identified legitimate use cases.
Yep.
Now, what is your organization recommending to allow law enforcement to get what it needs to keep us safe, and some of the most heinous criminals in the world could be identified with this technology, while respecting civil liberties? I mean, what are the action items for either the FBI or for Congress, which seemed creeped out by this?
Right.
What are the policies that could be put in place to allow this technology to be used for good, but not trample on civil liberties?
Right. A couple different rules. Let me try to outline them quickly. If you're a police officer in the street, you physically encounter someone, you need to know, is this a wanted felon or is this just, a law-abiding citizen? You at least need to have a reasonable suspicion they've committed a crime, right? That's the standard to stop someone. Okay, make that the standard for using face recognition on them. If you are identifying someone in secret after the fact against a mugshot database, we say reasonable suspicion of a serious crime, of a felony. Okay. Driver's license, though, as we talked about earlier, that's never happened before. There's never been a sort of default biometric database of all adults. And so for driver's license, we think those searches should not occur unless the people of that state had said, yes, We want those searches to occur. Otherwise, they should not be allowed. And even if they're allowed, you should go to a judge to say, hey, judge, you know, we have probable cause that this individual pictured here is committed a serious crime, something on the wiretap list, for example, something you can wiretap for. And then the judge can okay that and then go search a driver's license database. And so there's a couple different rules like that we propose. Again, not banning the technology, but saying making sure it's targeted at actual serious crime and not people at a protest or jaywalkers, you know, or people who are late on paying their parking tickets.
Now, has FBI argued that this would be too burdensome and that it would prevent them from doing their jobs? I mean, you obviously have to take those claims with a grain of salt. If you're a law enforcement agency, it is irrational for you to support anything that curtails your authority, right? That they're not exactly the people you ask about the wisdom of a policy that is obviously impacting them. But they might turn around and say, unless the emergency exception is good enough, my example of the guy running into the metro, how is it going to play there? So is there that exception for those extraordinary circumstances
where
real-time surveillance might need it to be, you know, instead of driver's license, we're dealing with real-time footage? Do your recommendations allow for those instances?
Yes, indeed. So let's go to wiretaps for a second. Let's say there's an emergency wiretap. We need to know what this dangerous terrorist is saying right now. Not terrorist, because that's actually a different wiretap. This dangerous criminal. We think there's going to be an attack, and we don't have time to go to the judge. You can do an emergency wiretap and then go to a judge. We have the same procedure in our model legislation, where if you need to do an emergency wiretap for a true emergency situation where life and limb is on the line, go do it. You know, go do that real-time face recognition, but then you got to go to a judge. And then you got to establish you had probable cause and that you had a good reason to do it and that it was a true bona fide emergency. And there's a couple of other instances, missing children, the victims of crimes, where you want this technology to be used. But right now, there are no rules, right? There are no rules to have exceptions for. There are no rules. And so it's a wild west as to who can do what. We want to move us out of that world and into a world where there are rules.
Well, I encourage listeners to check out the report. It's really some excellent work. And Alvaro, thank you for the work you've done on this. And you did a great job at the hearing of raising some of these issues. And I hope that it does lead to more discussion among members of Congress. Any final words before we part?
In fact, yeah. I am pleased to say, just relay what I heard at the hearing, which was that Chairman Jim Jordan, Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, Republican, is partnering with Congressman Ted Lieu of California to actually introduce legislation on the subject, on police face recognition or FBI face recognition. We'll wait to see what the bill says. But I'm happy to report, bipartisan work is being done to try to move us into that world where there are rules.
Yeah, and once we see what the specifics are, we'd be happy to have you back on the show for an update. But we'll leave it there. My guest has been Alvaro Bedoya, Executive Director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. For more on this topic, you can go to perpetuallineup.org to see how your state stacks up against others, and we will link to that in the show notes for today. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review. It'll help others find this show. And if you like this podcast and want to support it, go to givewithdata.com, answer a couple questions, and we get $5, so that's easy. We'll see you next time.
Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.